A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the Fourth be with you all month and beyond.
What about my brand name?
You're listening to Properly Howard, a podcast that covers classic film and other pulp fiction. This week, we revisit The Departed, which is Martin Scorsese's remake of Infernal Affairs. This is a movie with a lot of problems, laughably bad at times, but I cannot get enough of this movie. Make sure that you check out thelorehounds.com for all of the quality programming that David and John and Marilyn and Alicia are doing. Next week, we'll be covering the Nick Cage remake of The Wicker Man, so you can prep for that. And as promised at the end of this podcast, Steve and I discuss his Properly Howard-themed tattoo. Without further ado, here is stand-up comic Steve Osborne. My story is not anywhere near as interesting as yours, but I recently got my first tattoo.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's because my daughter is an artist, and she got herself a tattoo kit.
Did she really?
Yeah, very rudimentary, yeah. And it's just a simple ink and needle kit. It's as close to getting a tattoo in jail as you can possibly
now,
get.
Is it good enough to be like, yeah, this is permanent?
It's permanent, all right. And it hurts like hell.
Where'd you get it?
It was on my right shoulder. Where's yours?
Left shoulder.
Left shoulder, all right. So I thought, you know, she was like, I'm going to start doing this. I'm going to start practicing on myself. I'm like, no. I want your first tattoo to be on me.
Wow.
And because I was always thinking about a tattoo. Of course, I'm always pretty cheap when it comes to these things. And I thought, free's a good price. I thought, I'm just going to get something really simple. I got myself a little heart. That's, you know, about 2-inch by 2-inch heart with a little arrow through it with an S in the middle.
For me?
Well, I didn't want to spoil things. It is an homage to Steve and my wife Sarah and Superman. So yes. Those are the three.
So depending on who you're with.
So yeah, and I just thought for my first tattoo, I want to feel like I'm in jail. And It hurt like the certain jabs hurt more than others. And of course you have to understand my daughter is a good artist, but she's never poked needles into people.
Right. Before. So she doesn't have that deft touch quite yet, probably.
Not yet. And of course, once you get good at tattooing, you've got better equipment, right?
Right. For sure.
So anyway, it was an experience. It didn't last 10 and a half hours, though. I'll say that much. It's a pretty simple tattoo. But I think that maybe for the second tattoo, you know, maybe it'll be a different experience.
I love the idea that you just like people are like, so what do these tattoos signify? Oh, rough draft.
So, yeah, I was thinking about filling, you know, making it a little bit more detailed than what it is right now.
Gotcha. Well, that's great. Look at us, huh?
Yeah. We didn't even coordinate this.
I know. That's pretty impressive because you didn't know I was getting one.
You had mentioned a month ago or so, like I'm thinking about maybe a tattoo or here or there, but the entire trip to Boston was a big surprise.
Yeah. It was timing was not great, because I have so much other stuff going on. I was sandwiched in between gigs, and just meant like not being home as much as I would have liked to have been. But the trip was fantastic. Salem, like when you get into like the town, it's like a lot of it's like kind of one lane roads. It's super touristy, so it's not really, it's made more for walking at that point. I really like it. I mean, it's, they certainly lean into witch theme. People are super nice. This is my first time ever in that area, so everything seemed fake, right? Like my only interaction or awareness of East Coast or like Boston area type stuff is through like film and television, right? So so these accents are not accents I really encounter, and like all the architecture, like I'm like, ah, this kind of feels fake, even though it's like authentically old, but because it all,
like in Disneyland or something.
Yeah. So listening to people, like just the music, the locals, their speech was intoxicating, especially when it was just like at its absolute fevered pitch. Like California people tend to low talk at a table, like in a restaurant. Man, not in Salem or the Boston area. I'm not talking to her. I love that. That was my favorite. My favorite, so, when she picked up her phone and looked at her text. Oh, just that.
So one of my favorite Boston experiences is, this is a few years back, and I go into a bar. This bar is just packed. I'm at the edge of the bar, and I just want a beer. And finally, the bartender, I get the bartender's attention. She comes over. And she says, "What do you have, hun?" I don't know. There's something about being called hun that doesn't work unless there's an accent.
Right.
Right. So I kind of went a little Northern California on her without knowing it. What I said was, could I get a, and she immediately mocked me.
Well,
like my voice went up. It was sort of like, "Hey, I want you to like me. Can you get me a beer?" You know, that kind of voice. It's like, "Oh yeah, can I get it?" She immediately went, "Meh, meh, meh, meh. Why you talk like that?"
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah.
I'm thinking like, wait, I'm here to pay money to you to buy me a beer. I don't want to be made fun of because I'm a little bit feminine.
Oh man. That's how everybody was. There was kind of this like, what's the matter with you? Like
that was it. It was, what's the matter with you? Why are you gay?
Right.
And I'm thinking, but I think it's okay to be gay.
Right. And it's funny because that's what, like, they say that all the time. Like I had a boss from Danvers, and she would say things were gay, and they were like, you can't do that. And she's like, "I don't mean like gay. I mean like it's bad." I'm like, that's our point. Like that's, there's an,
do you see a problem
there?
Here,
there's an equivalency that you're drawing from. That's like, Oh my gosh. And she just was so like, it was just not.
It's just exasperated.
Yeah, like, exasperated.
You don't know what I mean. I'm not homophobic. I just think that things that are bad, you should call gay.
Right. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Like, can we just maybe use this as an opportunity?
It's almost like if you're not hyper masculine in this culture, you get mocked.
Oh, yeah.
Like it would not take me very long to put on a Southie accent if I, you know, give me a month.
Right.
If I lived there a month, I would go full Goodwill Hunting.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. Like, I start thinking, like, whenever I go visit a place and I have a good time, like, could I live here? Right. And, and I don't know. Like, I mean, I think I could, I probably could. And like I said, the people were like, even when they're mocking you, it felt, like already a friendly mocking, you know what I mean? So there's something about that was kind of fun and just made me feel at home. Yeah, they're just busting balls.
Well, I think we should probably talk about The Departed.
The Departed.
So there's a lot of ways we could get into this, but I think I'll just start this conversation by saying that this is the craziest Jack has ever been in a movie. He's so insane in this movie. And I can't take my eyes off it. This guy is just, he's clownishly insane. And it's almost like I'm going to be half Satan and half clown in this movie.
The cops are saying he's a cop. So I won't look for the cop. And you saw Fitz, when I tell you to dump a body in the marsh, you dump him in the marsh. Not where some guy from John Hancock goes every Thursday to get a fucking blowjob! Don't laugh! This ain't reality TV!
And I love it. I'm just in for it. I would just love to watch this guy be this insane for 2.5 hours as many times as I'm allowed to do it. So, I mean, of course, you know, DiCaprio's great and, you know, Damon's great or whatever. There's a lot of interesting performances. There's a lot of overacting in this movie. You know, we could talk about the accents or whatever, but I just think that Jack is mesmerizing in this film. And I don't know. It's sort of a guilty pleasure for me anyway.
Interesting. Because you really like this movie.
I like it. Sarah asked me this morning. She's like, did you like that one? You know what? I really do. And I know other people don't. I know that there's a lot of people who just can't stand this movie. I can't get enough.
I definitely liked it more the second time I watched it. Like the first time I was kind of like, all right, whatever. And I don't know, it must have, you know, there's context, right? Like who knows when, like, well, like when, if I was in the right headspace,
sure,
distracted, you know, trying to keep up a little bit with like who's what and like, and I think if you don't immediately catch, you know, who's working for what, it's not that confusing, but if you don't catch it right away, like you have one of those like, okay, so wait a minute, who's what, who's doing what now?
My feeling with Scorsese is that he's a hit or miss director for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are some of his movies that I adore and will watch over
like
and
Last
over.
Temptation of Christ. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Why not? There are some movies that I can't stand. Like I'm just not into Taxi Driver. I'm not into The Aviator. There are certain movies that he does that I feel like are just misses. Whenever I go into a Scorsese movie, I think, this could easily be The Color of Money or Goodfellas. Or it could be something else that I don't really enjoy very much. So it's almost like because he does have a spotty record, I'm never really hyped up for a Scorsese movie. Whereas I think a lot of people walked into this movie thinking, well, he's one of our great directors. I can't wait to watch The Wolf of Wall Street again or something like that.
Right, right.
Anyway, that is my feeling about Scorsese. And I feel like he hits more than he misses.
Probably because he hits big, right?
Right. Yeah. If he hits big, it'll be in Oscar conversation.
Well, yeah. And so if he hits big, it becomes like a cultural touchstone. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, you may not like Taxi Driver, but it's part of culture. You know, I mean, quotes and
yeah, you are not going to get through film school and not watch Taxi Driver.
Right. So it's like, so the impact that like, so if he misses, you kind of move past it. But if he hits, it makes a difference. But this might be one of those, like, he wins his Oscar finally, right? Because that was the big thing, right? Like, he just didn't win Oscars. And so I think this one has a certain, I don't want to say a stink to it, but there is this feeling like, well, they felt like who knows how many Oscar, you know, worthy films he's got left. And you'd hate to miss out, right, on giving him one.
Well, he's one of the, all right, so that's a good point. It's like, he's one of the great American directors. You've got at least 100 movies that are copying his style. He, you know, if you come up with a list of, you know, the top 100 movies, he's got at least 3 in there. And he's never won an Oscar. And so even though this one is is it even in his top 10? I don't know.
Right. It's a good question.
But you start to think, Well, maybe we give him the Oscar. And maybe it was a poor year for Oscar, you know, for maybe movies or whatever, but it kind of helps to have the star power. It's like if Leo is going to be in a movie, it's going to get attention, right? And then you add all those actors around him. You can kind of create a recipe for Oscar buzz.
I'm looking at the other nominated movies that year, and there was Babel, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, and The Queen.
Yeah, some good movies in there. I wouldn't like say like, oh, geez, going up against.
I mean, Little Miss Sunshine, I think is pretty great.
It's pretty great. It's sort of an atypical movie to win Best Picture.
Right.
That seems like a Best Supporting Actor kind of flick.
Pan's Labyrinth was in the same year.
So yeah, and how many of those movies had Damon and DiCaprio and Nicholson and Martin Sheen's in this movie?
Right. Alec Baldwin's in this movie.
Can I just say that Mark Wahlberg, it's funny. It's like Mark Wahlberg has got to be like the 12th best actor in this film. But I look forward to his scenes so much.
Sergeant Dickens, right. Our liaison to the undercover section. His undercover work is extensive. He's here to give us his report, Sergeant Dickham.
Okay. My people are out there. They're like fucking Indians. You're not going to see them. You're not going to hear about them. Except through me or Captain Queenan. You will not ever know the identity of undercover people. Unfortunately, this shithole has more fucking leaks than the Iraqi Navy.
Fuck yourself.
I'm tired from fucking your wife.
How's your mother?
Good. She's tired from fucking my father.
Do you have anyone in with Costello presently?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
He's just totally committed to this, this role.
It feels like he wasn't even cast. He just kept forced, like he was that character and forced his way on the set. And Scorsese and everybody just like, I'm really nervous to tell him to leave.
I love Martin Sheen. There's just so much to love about this movie. It is not a perfect movie. This movie has tons of flaws.
Yeah, it does. But I think part of the reason why I liked it better this time is because I already kind of knew I was not, I wasn't crazy about it, right? Like, so here's the Oscar winning Scorsese film. I'm thinking, well, he didn't win for Goodfellas. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously this didn't go up against it.
Yeah. Whatever. This is going to be better than Goodfellas.
Right. Or at least it's got to be on par, right? You think, because if it's like, hey, maybe Goodfellas didn't win because the movies were so superior. And by the way, they weren't. There's no way Dances with Wolves is better than Goodfellas. Kicking Bird. So with this, I'm like, so your expectations are pretty high. You look at these actors, and like you just talked about, like this cast is amazing. And so like, I think I was like, this is fine. So watching it this time, I really enjoyed it. I actually really, really enjoyed it. And maybe even because of the flaws, because I was like, oh, this, like, I kind of took all the Scorsese-ness away from it and just, and just watched it and go, look at these actors just chewing up the Boston scenery, and some of them nailing the accents and some clearly not.
The accents are all over the place in this movie. I mean, for some people that will ruin it,
sure,
but for me, I kind of feel like if it's Jack, I kind of want to see Jack be Jack.
Yeah.
You know, if it's Gary Oldman, I want to see him disappear into that part. That's kind of why I love Gary Oldman. But if it's Jack, I kind of feel like just be Jack. You've made a pretty good career, you know, by being that guy. So I don't know. I don't know. The accents didn't ruin anything.
It'd be weird to cast Jack Nicholson because you want him to disappear.
Exactly.
I really want to do a bunch of rat noises. Of course you do. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you want to act like a rat?
I love the idea of Scorsese going to Jack and saying, like, I know you're semi-retired, but you know how like sometimes you're the devil in movies and sometimes you're just crazy in movies? I'd like to do a movie where you're both.
Can I bring my own dildo?
That That was an improv. Was an improvisation. That was his idea. He brought his own dildo. It was a joke you just made, but it really happened.
Yeah, I know.
That was not written. It was not written into the script. That was his idea.
Yeah, which seems like it might be a problem.
Might be a problem.
The very fact that like did he go and purchase it? Did he have one of his like assistants go get it? Was it already on his person?
I just watched the original Infernal Affairs, and I think that the one thing that's missing.
One thing that culture doesn't have the courage to do.
What we do in this country.
Amazing. Yeah. It really adds a little spice, a little cumin to this mix.
So I watched this movie about a week ago again. And then I watched Infernal Affairs for the first time, the movie upon which this film is based. And then I rewatched The Departed again after that film. The original is a decent movie. It is all in subtitles, created against the backdrop of Hong Kong instead of Boston.
It's still all Boston accents, which I think is an interesting choice.
And I mean, aside from sort of setting it in Boston and having some of our great actors play the parts, a lot of the plot points parallel. The ending is a little different. I won't say more than that for people that want to see the original. But there was one thing about that Hong Kong movie that helped explain this movie to me. And it is that it ends with a quote from the Buddha. And I'll read it to you. So after the final scene of Infernal Affairs, you see against black, you see this text. He who is in continuous hell never dies. Longevity is a great hardship in continuous hell. So I'd never heard that quote before, and it's almost to say that,
yeah, you don't get that one in a fortune cookie.
Yeah, right. This is the difference between Buddhism in San Francisco and Buddhism in Hong Kong, I suppose. I came to the realization that I knew that Scorsese has been quoted a lot about the fact that he feels like he's going to hell. Mm. Have you seen any of this?
No.
Okay, he's quoted a lot about him talking about his Catholicism. So he's very religious in terms of his worldview, but he himself feels like he's going to hell. And my feeling is, what I realized is, that's what made that Infernal Affairs interesting to him. He really is exploring the concept of the longevity of someone who's living through hell. And I kind of feel like this explains a lot of his movies. This is a man who's preoccupied with hell and who believes that he himself is going to hell. He's going to make movies over and over and over about people going to hell. I mean, you could name off a dozen movies. You know, this is a slow descent into depravity of this one kind of character. And, you know, Wolf of Wall Street or Goodfellas or whatever, you know, Taxi Driver.
Raging Bull.
Yeah, Raging Bull. There you go. These are all people going to hell. And I feel like that's what this is. This is sort of in Boston. This movie's set in Boston, but really it's set in continuous hell. These are people either by way of making the wrong choices consciously or, you know, trying to do the right thing, but end up, you know, fouling it up. These are all people on their way to hell. And if you watch the movie against that backdrop.
Well, and that's DiCaprio's character is damned, right? Like that's.
Everyone in this movie is damned. And in other words, if you don't want to say The Departed, this movie could be called The Damned.
Right.
And, you know, you look at Leonardo that he, you know, but what does he want more than anything by the end of this film? He's like, I don't want this life. I want my life back.
Right.
I want my identity back. I want my life back. And
essentially,
go ahead.
There is no life to be gained.
No.
This is your life.
And if you look at Jack as a Satan character, it's like, what is the one thing that Satan can't do? The Satan cannot give life.
Right.
God can give life. Satan cannot give life. Satan's very powerful. You know, Satan has a lot of fun. Satan, you know, can do a lot of things, especially if he's living in Boston. But he cannot give you your life back. And I kind of feel like that's what Scorsese's filmography is all about. It's about his preoccupation with hell and the people who are going to hell. And I feel like that theme is in this movie more prominently than maybe any other movie he's done.
That makes a lot of sense too, just because this movie is so tangled. Like every character is so tangled, and and I don't even know what I'm rooting for. You know, you do have this like, well, I wish better for this Leonardo DiCaprio character, just almost on principle, right? Not necessarily like we haven't really. We don't really establish him, and I think he does a really interesting job.
Well, he's not a sociopath, right? Matt Damon's right. Character is a sociopath.
Right. He is, but he also like, well, how much of that is this nature or nurture, right? I mean, he gets caught up by, you know, if you want to, for lack of a better, or to follow your theme, he gets swallowed up by the devil at a young age. Right.
Absolutely.
I mean, and so,
and the thesis of the movie, I mean, they tell you the thesis in the first minute. The thesis is there's no difference between cops and criminals, right?
Right.
And so he gets
essentially
caught up.
Which essentially is saying there is no difference between good and evil.
Right. That's right. The very first line of this movie was to say, you know, we once had the church, which is just to say that we had each other. You know, that's kind of one of the first lines of the film. And so early on, we established Costello as, you know, he's like a heretic. He's a mob boss. He's a pervert. He's a racist. You know, this guy is Satan incarnate, basically. And how do you exist in that guy's orbit and not get dirty? And that's what happens to DiCaprio. And then the question is, can you ever really wash that dirt off you?
Right.
And I think Scorsese's view of this is, no, you can't. You got into this with the best of intentions, but you're damned like the rest of these guys.
Like for me, watching it a second time, looking at a Matt Damon character, yeah, as a sociopath, but like trying to find an opportunity to see him as human. And he does it. Matt Damon is sneaky good because really pulls this off. And this is a character,
sneaky good villainous actor,
right?
I mean, you know, he's like he's Jason Bourne and he's Good Will Hunting and all of this business. Yeah. He's kind of known for those roles, but I could come up with four or five movies where he's just a really great villain too.
Yeah. And his villainy in this one really, he makes some really good choices in this performance, in that like he could have made him more sympathetic, or he could have tried to, but he really just sort of plays it like honestly, like he's earnest in the sense of like, well, this is just what I do.
Yeah.
And there is like, there's just no moral conflict for him.
Right.
But it's not done like over the top. It's just, it's super authentic. And then when you get to the end, when, you know, he basically just gets rid of the devil, he's like, all right, well, I guess I'll just keep on doing it. I mean, he just doesn't stop. You know,
Well, he can't. Yeah. He's already chosen his path. He's already on the road to hell. In sort of keeping with the one thing the devil can't do is create life, there is an impotency theme that's running through this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
You know, like Jack doesn't have a son. And of course, Damon is impotent, or he's having, you know, problems in the bedroom. And she shows him the sonogram, but you're kind of not sure. Is this really Damon's
right.
kid?
We know this, right? And,
right. Yeah.
And he has almost no reaction, which I think is fascinating.
He doesn't feel anything.
Right.
He's sort of cut off that part of his emotionality. You know, he to feel something would mean that you're you've embraced a certain kind of life where if you're always pretending, and almost everyone in this movie is pretending something. If you're always pretending, you never know which emotion is appropriate at that particular moment, because you're thinking through all of the maneuvers.
Right. And there's a fascinating part where, like, you know, when Costello's questioning DiCaprio's Costigan character and basically, you know, accusing him of being the rat. Hey, you're the new guy. There's a lot of just lots of questions about you. You left, you know, when we were getting all the lists of everybody's, you know, identification. Mm-hmm. And then he's pushing back and saying, you know, like, look, all these people have been with you for a long time. You know, they probably think that they could do it better. And you start looking at this crew and you're like, well, this crew seems like they seem like ideal lackeys, except for one crew member. Yeah. And that's the crew member that's never there. And that's Sullivan, right? I mean, like, Damon's character is really the one that, like, where Costello's this kind of erratic, you know, wild guy in many ways. Sullivan could run that much more, you know, adeptly, you would think, right? Like, I mean, nobody would cross him.
He's just as evil and murderous as Costello, but it hasn't driven him crazy yet.
Right. Yeah, there's such an undercurrent of who do you trust and the betrayal and it. And once you've created this world, what's the difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, so that theme of what's the difference goes all the way through, right? Because even when Wahlberg gets his, you know, his version of justice, it's still vigilante, right? I mean,
that's right. It's not justice. He's cleaning up the garbage.
Yeah, he's not operating as a cop. He's operating as mm-hmm. himself. And then,
really is no difference between criminals and villains in this world.
Right. And then it just ends, right? And then he goes off and it's like, okay, well, that's not like it's solved, or at least in, you know, they're just gone. but there's no justice in that, because there's no revelation. Now we know that he's, you know, it's been exposed.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is one of the nitpicks about this movie, is that you could say, well, there's evidence that these guys are corrupt. Why didn't the psychiatrist character turn in this evidence?
Yeah, that's to me the biggest gap, right? Like, it doesn't, like, so she gets the big reveal, you know, she discovers it, and the punishment is we're breaking up.
Right. And I think, I mean, the only way I could make that work is that she is as corrupt as everyone else in this movie. But for her, it manifests as, I don't want my child growing up thinking that his father is a criminal. So I'm going to kind of keep this under wraps so I can keep pretending, keep the even keel or whatever. Because established she's not above lying.
Right. In fact, that's a key element of you know, her and DiCaprio's dynamic, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. he allows her to embrace that part, and that's where their relationship is sort of built on. It's the idea of falsehoods.
How long have you been with this guy?
My boyfriend?
Yeah. What would you do if you were standing right there and you saw us? Huh?
I would lie. Yeah, I would lie. You know, to keep things on an even keel, right?
This movie, more than anything, does kind of show the equal corruption of cops and robbers in a city like this. And a lot of movies have attempted to do this, but I feel like this is sort of my favorite depiction of that. And you've got a lot of symmetry in this movie. You know, you got one guy undercover for the mob boss and one guy undercover for the police. And this movie is all about the symmetry.
Right.
You are the mirror of me. And, you know, there may be other movies that have attempted to do that with cops and criminals. This happens to be my favorite.
Well, and I thought it was really interesting, too, when you have this final interaction with the DiCaprio and Sullivan character. He's, I'm going to arrest you, but you're not a cop, you know, like, but he's that's him trying to get that identity back. Right.
Right.
I need the world to know that I'm not a bad guy. And when Martin Sheen's character dies, like that link to his, to the identity he wishes he had is dies with it.
Yeah.
And so it's this like ever opening chasm that just keeps swallowing and he just can't claw his way out.
So I've been doing a lot of research on stories, like just what to do with a story, how to make a character compelling. I'm reading this book called Story by Robert McKee. They use it in a lot of film classes. And, that's not where I got this. I was listening to another podcast with Craig Mazin, who did the most recent Chernobyl films and
The Last of Us.
Yeah, he also did a lot Last of Us. He's got a podcast where he talks about screenwriting. And they were talking about the four F's. Like what motivates every single person in the world? You know, if you just boil it down, it comes down to the four F's. You're motivated by fight, flight, feeding, or fornicating. You can boil down everything to those basic primary intentions. And I was thinking about that this movie in those terms. I was thinking like, you know, just the most primary needs of humanity. If you can't procreate, you have a problem. Or if you're, you know, I guess one thing that Mazin said was any movie that's about drugs or addiction is kind of a movie about feeding, fighting, and of course, if you're trying to stay hidden, you're fleeing. This movie does it really well with all of these primary motivations: fight, flight, feed, and fornicate. It's what makes a character compelling. And boy, you got a ton of all of that in this film.
That's all the interaction with DiCaprio and the psychiatrist character, right? I mean, you get it all in there.
You also have that scene with Alec Baldwin. He's like, you know, it's good to be married. Because, you know, people don't think you're a weirdo.
Right, right. Yeah, hit Barry.
And people, you know, women know that your cock works. And, you know, you look like you got a little bit of money in the bank. These are all sort of how to sort of pretend to be normal in Boston, right? Right. And, of course, this is the problem. This is the problem for Damon's character. He's got all of the problems.
Right.
Like his money's ill-begotten. He's like not normal at all. He's leading a double life. You know, he's got all of the problems that make him kind of subhuman,
right?
In from this particular worldview. Steve, who's this movie made for?
It's a good question. I mean, it's like I think if we follow what you were talking about, I think this is Scorsese maybe initially makes this movie for himself.
Yeah, maybe this is a movie just for Scorsese.
Like this is part of his, this is his penance.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I was thinking also for people who, I mean, this is a movie for sinners. This is for people who like are depraved and like to think about being depraved.
Right. So it's funny, like, cause I know that you've some of the issues that you've had, you know, with Scorsese films is that you've said it. You don't love the portrait of somebody spiraling out of control.
Yeah, it's sort of a biopic, but it's a biopic of a person who is becoming more and more depraved or spiraling into insanity or something like
that. Right. And typically you get exhausted by that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think it can be done well. You know, I think Wolf of Wall Street is a great example. Like, that's just a fascinating movie. You have to, with Scorsese, you have to be resolved that at the end of this movie, there will be no redemption,
Right.
which is just another way to say these characters are going to hell.
Right.
But you sort of demythologize it a bit. But if you want a redemptive ending in a movie, do not go to Martin Scorsese for it.
Right. And do you prefer redemption?
It depends on the movie. Like for I usually do prefer redemption. Like if you look at my top 10 list, they're usually movies with happy endings. But this is a movie absolutely without. I mean, it may be the movie with the worst ending ever. So so I don't know. I don't know if I this is in my top 10, but I really do like this movie.
Yeah, so it's interesting how, but there's something I find fascinating about you liking this movie as much as you do because of what I know about you. And
Yeah.
like this would be like up there if Heather's like, yeah, this movie's like crazy sweaty, but I can't stop watching it.
Sure. Well, I do like Pulp Fiction. I think that Pulp Fiction is like it would be in the same algorithm, right? If you liked Wolf, if you liked The Departed, Netflix might also suggest to you Pulp Fiction or whatever. If it's done well, if the movie is done well, and I'm entertained by it, then I'll absolutely forgive the ending. CF my Game of Thrones experience.
You could argue that Pulp Fiction, the Jules character, is the closest we get to at least the pursuit of redemption, right? Like we don't know if it resolves,
Sure.
but it doesn't. It certainly doesn't end in a way that says there's no redemption, right? So there's like this interesting glimmer of hope there, and there's a lot more whimsy, right?
I think you're right. That is a movie with certain elements, at least enough redemption that you could imagine, like, well, Jules is off walking the earth. But of course, the other interpretation is that is like, without legal tender, Jules has decided to be a bum, So it's sort of a, it's in the eye of the beholder, right? But Butch
Butch
escapes, I
escapes
guess.
and Zed is dead.
Right. This movie, no one escapes. Everyone's departed, except for Mark Wahlberg. You don't get the sense that he's a very happy guy. I don't imagine that Mark Wahlberg goes home to a loving wife and children. He's probably an asshole in every single aspect of his life.
Problem
So
solved. All right, I can relax.
this is a guy who yells about everything.
This might be the most enjoyable. I mean, I enjoy Mark Wahlberg and the other guys, but that might be
He's pretty
more.
great in the other.
He's pretty
Again,
good. Yeah.
very similar
Yeah.
character, right?
Right. And I mean, look, give Wahlberg credit, right? I mean, he's made a fine acting career. But you look and you go, this would be the outlier if there was going to be one. But like what he does to this character feels pretty authentic, you know, for this film.
I love to see him juxtaposed with Martin Sheen, who really is giving off this paternal, aw shucks vibe. They call him a good Catholic. His kid's going to Notre Dame. You get the idea that this is the kind of guy you want looking after you.
But he's also
But the
doing
very
nothing to
fact that
stop
he,
this guy.
that's right. The very fact that he's willing to tolerate the existence of Mark Wahlberg's character has you wondering, like, is this guy really all that good?
Right. No, that's I think the beauty of that, right? He just it's like, is he ineffectual or is he really just like, no, this is how good cop, bad cop works, but it's sweetheart cop and just nightmare cop.
I got a question. How fucked up are you?
You a psychiatrist?
Well, if I was, I'd ask you why you're a statey making 30 grand a year, and I think if I was Sigmund fucking Freud, I wouldn't get an answer. So tell me, what's a lace curtain motherfucker like you doing in the stateies?
Families are always rising or falling in America, am I right?
Who said that?
Hawthorne.
What's the matter, smart ass? You don't know any fucking Shakespeare?
We have a question. Do you want to be a cop? Or do you want to appear to be a cop? It's an honest question. A lot of guys want to appear to be cops. Your gun, badge, pretend they're on TV.
The respect, sir. What do you want from me?
Hey, asshole, he can't help you. I know what you are, okay? I know what you are, and I know what you're not. I'm the best friend you have on the face of this earth, and I'm going to help you understand something, you punk. You're no fucking cop.
He's right. We deal in deception here. What we do not deal with is self-deception.
It's like kindly old uncle and the school bully are happen to be best friends, right? Love it. Fantastic. Genuinely, first time I saw it, genuinely surprised by Martin Sheen's exit.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, Martin Sheen, this guy who has been in some of the all-time great films. He starred in some of the all-time great films. And in this film, he's happy to like, yeah, I'm happy to play right field here.
Yeah.
I'm happy to bat ninth in this film. Okay, I'm happy to play second fiddle to Mark Wahlberg.
Right.
If it means making a better movie. Talk about a good Catholic.
Yeah, that is a very Catholic move to yield to Mark Wahlberg.
So one tweak that you think would improve this movie?
I think the psychiatrist character felt a little prop-ish.
Does Scorsese write women?
That was going to be my next question, because I'm looking and I'm like, I feel like women are just sort of like, they just sort of help move the men along a lot of times.
I was just thinking of Color of Money. Remember how we loved what was her name? Antonio Masterson. What was that actress's name?
Mary Elizabeth
Molly Masterson Antonio
McMuffin.
McMuffin. She was amazing in Color of Money.
Yeah.
She was fantastic. And then Deborah Winger is an interesting window into this and Goodfellas. But you're right. He is. He's really interested in men behaving badly,
right?
In almost all of his movies. So you're right. That character could have been
because I think if you flesh her out more, her having the evidence and not doing anything with it, we don't have to like do these sort of like you know narrative gymnastics to make that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's an interesting dynamic between the three of them that she's sort of in the center of this as well. But I just didn't really she just felt like somebody who was going to just spend most of the movie disappointed. And
well, yeah, that's right. And she's a bridge, right? She functions literally as a bridge between these two characters to kind of show their symmetry in a different kind of way. They're both sleeping with the same woman.
And her role, you know, she, like I said, she almost feels a little bit reduced to a metaphor, right? Mm-hmm. Which I will get to, because my biggest tweak, you know, is the metaphor.
it's the rat at the end.
It's the rat at the end.
It doesn't bother me. I don't know why. It's like sort of like,
okay, rat is said like probably, I don't know, 47 to 100 times in this movie. Or acted out. Like, so that was a hard part watching the second time. Every time the word rat gets mentioned, I just start. Mm-hmm. I got a little cringy. I'm like, it's coming. Why? Yeah. Why is there a rat? Why does there have to be a rat? Like, like what is that moment? Like, that is the moment where Scorsese completely undercuts. It's like, what are you doing? Like, what? How does that help anything? Like, is there anybody going, oh, there's that rat? Like, what? Like, it would have been better if the rat, like, turned to the camera and said something. Like, at that point. Like, if then it, like, the rat turns.
So the rat holds up a little sign that says, Jesus saves, or something at the end.
Or he just does the Buddhist quote. He says it. I don't know. I mean, it's such a unbelievably unnecessary moment.
Yeah.
And it's like, in my mind it was longer because of how much I hated it, so I was a little bit like little better with it, because I'm like, all right, it's at least it's right there. And but it just, I just, for the life of me, somebody. Like
I get it. I get it. You know, it's a legitimate criticism. For some reason, it doesn't ruin anything for me, but I totally get it. My feeling is that
he didn't know if we understood that a rat is an animal.
I was going to tell you my tweak.
Okay. All rats. It basically Secret of NIMH.
I thought this movie was going to be more about racial tension in Boston.
Mm.
He starts, you know, if you're going to drop the N-word in the first minute of a movie, you got to tell me that story.
You want to hear it more?
Well, I want you to earn it. I want you to be like, I don't want this to sort of be superficial.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
If you're going to do that at the beginning of a movie, this had better be a movie about race. You better be able to say something interesting that makes that character, you need to make that theme real to me. And I don't feel like that's what this movie does at all. I feel like there's a couple of things early on in the movie where they do talk about race in Boston. They show the documentary footage. You've got the voiceover from Jack. And then you've also got DiCaprio mentioning something to his cadet buddy about being black in Boston. Right, right.
Like you got a hard enough or whatever, just being black in Boston.
So you give me those three things in the first 10 minutes of the movie and then don't do anything with race for the entire movie.
Right.
It seems like an oversight. And the one thing that I can kind of come up with, if you were going to try to find a way into this topic, is that why does he choose the cop that he does to reveal himself to at the end?
Anthony Anderson.
Yeah. So he has Anthony Anderson meet him on the rooftop when he's going to arrest Matt Damon. And he says, "You know me." And I was almost thinking, like, is this sort of, without saying it, he chose him because he knows he's never going to be fully accepted in the police force anyway. So he's kind of going to be a liminal character anyway because of the racism in Boston. This is the guy that is not going to be fully in on, you know, team cop or whatever.
Mm.
So, but I feel like I'm almost sort of talking myself out of that, because I feel like if that was the story that you're going to tell, you got to give me more Anthony Anderson in this film.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, that would be my tweak.
Yeah. And I think also it's like, I think the one other aspect of it is Scorsese may have had no interest in making a movie about race relations in Boston, but to not show racism in Boston would be to not show Boston.
Okay. All right. I get it. I mean, it does establish Jack as just a wholly evil character from the beginning. And I think that there's something about Jack's charisma that even if he is playing Satan, you kind of like Satan when he's playing that role. And I think maybe Scorsese is like, you're not going to like this guy. I'm going to make sure you do not like this guy.
Right.
Were there any cliches, tropes, or devices that you liked in this film?
I think I am a sucker for the deep undercover.
Sure.
You know, I think I like the spiral more than you. In fact, I know I do. Watching somebody lose themselves on screen, I think is always, I always enjoy that. I'm kind of fascinated by that. Baldwin with a Boston accent, probably another trope I enjoy.
Baldwin has had a few really, really funny lines in this film. Steve, was this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film?
I would say the overwhelming majority of it, I'd give a Howard plus 4. The rat scene is a Howard minus 12.
So this is a Howard minus 8 if taken together.
Well, you have to do like an aggregate, you know, you got to like factor in the screen time of the rat.
Got it. I see. So the screen time of the rat was sort of like 20 seconds in a two and a half hour movie.
Yeah, so this still comes out as like a Howard plus like
3.8 or something like that.
Right.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm going to say I like Howard plus four on this. And I feel like it's high. I'm tempted to go maybe a little Howard plus three or something like that. So we're kind of in the same ballpark here. The acting is, the acting's really amazing.
It is. It's a joy to watch from that perspective, right? I mean, like I'd say the dialogue, this is where I think the acting raises the dialogue. I think there's some good dialogue, but it's definitely helped by the performances.
Is there a half the battle won DeGron moment in this film?
Yeah, just let Jack bring his props whenever.
You can't go wrong with Jack Nicholson bringing his own props.
Yeah, he's sort of like a macabre Carrot Top.
Steve, we haven't done iTunes reviews in a while. I don't know if you've been keeping up with our iTunes reviews.
I didn't know we were still doing this podcast.
We are. And we do appreciate iTunes reviews. We got our first really bad review. I thought it would be really fun to read it.
Yeah.
So it's, I just have to say, I like to think that the person's still listening just to see if we'll read the review. No. This review is one star. It's from Arn Disney, ARN Disney. I don't know what that, I mean, is this just Bob Iger? Is that what?
Did we take a shot at a Disney production?
I don't know. Maybe. maybe we did. Maybe it was White Man Can't Jump. We said that it had kind of a Disney ending or something.
Mm.
So this reviewer says boring. That's the title of the boring, one star, literally boring and not fun. I think we know the age of this person just by the use of the word literally.
Yeah.
The hosts think that they're hilarious. ... Nope.
No, they're wrong. We do think we're hilarious. I don't understand. How are you arguing with that?
Had to change the name because it was too hard to spell. # fail.
Okay. Wow.
So I
thought they were young, but the very fact that they're still doing # commentary, like that's
well, this is even worse. This is a
I thought for sure this was one of our kids, but this might be one of our parents.
This is a baby boomer who is trying desperately to fit in with Gen Z.
This is awesome.
I love that. So anyway, Bob Iger, if you're listening, I would recommend listening to whatever podcast that you did not like another 20 times, because I guarantee you that we will raise the bar from boring to mediocre.
Oh yeah, I stand by that. Yeah.
So White Man Can't Jump, just listen to that podcast another 19 times, and I think we're good. I think we've solved that.
Yeah, no cap.
All right, and then we got a good review. This is from
the same person,
B. Roar. The title of the review is Perfect Pop Culture Nonsense. I think that summarizes us.
Ooh.
5 stars. These guys crack me up. Perfect listening on a Monday to get me laughing and in a good mood for the week. It's been fun to learn about their other podcasts that they're a part of. Can't wait for more.
I prefer that one, yeah.
I don't know. The other one was pretty funny.
Literally.
Literally funny. Along the lines of pop culture nonsense, I'd like to ask you about your new purchase.
Ah, yeah. Well, I think it all kind of ties in with today's movie, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, maybe not, well, thematically, but in terms of where I went.
Well, no, I think that there's a lot of connections. You know, the werewolf theme, okay, connecting with Nicholson, you know, there's just a lot there. So let's start at the beginning. You've been thinking about a new tattoo.
Well, I've been thinking about a tattoo. I have tattoos.
Right. You were thinking about your first tattoo.
Well, and talking to people in the tattooed community, and please feel free to chime in and email us, and if you're inked and you want to talk about it, Like, there's a lot of emphasis put on that first one, right? And then, you know, people get more, I think it becomes a little bit more like, yeah, whatever, you know. Not that it's not important, but, like, I think in some cases you feel like you can have a little bit more, like, take a little more liberties once you've already sort of broke the ice. Mm-hmm.
Because when you do the first one, you think, maybe this will be the only thing that I ever do.
Right.
And this is sort of, this single tattoo will define me for the rest of my life.
Right. If I get no other tattoo, then the message I'm sending is, this is all I ever needed for this. And this is the message.
Your second tattoo is a lot like your second child. You're like, whatever.
Yeah. I'll just have another one if this one doesn't work out. So, like, I don't know if you know this about me, but I had been talking about a tattoo probably since middle school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as one does, right? When you're in middle school, you think to yourself, like, oh, man, I want to get something, like, real cool.
What was your first idea for a tattoo, you know?
I was young? Something from Looney Tunes, but, like, I wanted it to be, like, a more obscure character. Like not a regular, like, it was, like, maybe the... like the chicken hawk. Yeah.
I've got a good friend who has a Wile E. Coyote.
That's nice.
And he's holding up one finger. And I was like, what's the tattoo about? He's like, he puts up one finger when he gets a little light bulb and says, super genius. So anyway.
Oh. He went with the talking.
It was a brave move.
That's probably the least embraced of the Wile E. Coyote. iterations is the one.
So you were thinking something along the lines of Foghorn Leghorn? Is that what you were thinking?
Well, the chicken hawk that went after him, you know, the little guy. So that was like not right, you know, not super obvious, but like, you know, recognized. So that was kind of where I was at, right? And time went on, and like then I just got to a point where I even incorporated like the idea of getting a tattoo in my act, because it's like I get buyer's remorse before I buy something kind of thing. You know, I just can't, I won't even get a bumper sticker because that just seems too permanent.
Sure.
You know, I'm like, you know, yeah, coexist seems like a good idea, but maybe I'm more racist than I give myself credit for.
But what if the day after you put coexist on your bumper, you realize I'm sort of alt-right deep down?
Yeah, exactly. I just slap that thing on and then vote for DeSantis. And it's like, I don't know. I'm zigging and zagging all over. So, but then you get to a point where it was like, all right, I like the show Ink Master. I really enjoy, like, I enjoy those kinds of reality shows where, like, there's interesting art, but also, like, people's lives are being ruined.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen it, but, like, you know, you'll take these artists and they all have to do, they have to do tattoo styles that they maybe don't do. And I love the idea of, like, they're like, okay, today is like realistic portrait day, and then somebody gets a person that has no idea how to do a realistic portrait, and then they just have like this really like creepy looking version of their grandma on their thigh or something like that. That tickles me.
All right.
But I was like, yeah, you know, I just like, I and it taught me a little bit more about like all the different styles and artistry that goes into to tattoos. And so I kind of got to a point where I was like, well, as I got older, maybe it's less about what the tattoo is specifically and maybe more about the artist behind it. If I'm okay with, you know, I'd like some color, I'd like it to be a little whimsical, I'd like it to at least, you know, not necessarily mean something, but be something I enjoy. So watching Ink Master, and always seemed to really enjoy one particular artist, Kelly Doty. I really liked her, kind of her new school stuff. She likes horror stuff, but she also really loves like 80s pop culture.
And I just did a little bit of research on this morning. So new school is an actual recognized style in the tattoo world.
Right. Kind of like more kind of caricature-ish, you know, like a lot of big eyes, kind of like, you know, yeah. So we got real, you know, kind of a whimsical take on something, right? I think it was November of 2022. Heather's like, why don't you just put an inquiry in to her shop and see what that even means, like see what it takes, right? So, you know, I filled out the form and was like, yeah, why not, right? I had a little bit of wine on board, let's go for it. And didn't hear anything till March. March, I get an email. And with all a series of questions, like, what do you want? What is this? Blah, 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 blah. And mm-hmm. I just sort of threw a bunch of stuff, not a bunch, but like I threw some ideas down, then didn't hear anything. And then she closed her books for the shop. And then I was like, well, I guess that's kind of it, right? And then August, I get an email again, like, hey, she's really excited about this idea. Can you, here's some dates. And it was like the next month. And so I was like, oh, I got to, if I'm going to really, and it was like, oh, we might actually have to do this. And I may have to fly to Salem, Massachusetts to make it happen. So we had miles on the Alaska account and just kind of just went for it.
And you went, and it was last weekend?
This last week. So, yeah, I got there and then doing all the right things, you know, drinking lots of water, lubing up the arm and all that good stuff. And 10 and a half straight hours.
One sitting, 10 and a half.
One hours. Sitting, like, still not even sure, like, because I'm, you know, watching that show, I'm like, well, some people just pass out, or they're like, their skin can't handle it. I'm like, what happens if I get there, all the way to Salem, sit in the chair, and like, she's like, yeah, I can't do this. Your body is, you're no good. So that was, I think,
your
I,
body I was more... is your body's a rotting canvas.
Exactly. She's like, have you seen this thing? I can't look at this for 10 hours. So I was, you know, and I hadn't even seen a design yet.
Yeah.
So I get there and I'm just like sitting there in the waiting room, just like, I don't even know what I'm about to sign up for. And I didn't know it was going to be that long. I thought it was going to be, I knew it would be long, but I was thinking maybe like 6 or 7 hours, which still was a lot, right? I mean.
Wait, you didn't, you weren't settled on a design. You flew all the way to Boston. You were not yet settled on a design.
Well, I knew what we were going to do.
Okay.
And because I gave her some options and there was one she was really excited about. So I knew I was going to get Teen Wolf dunking a basketball.
Oh, my goodness.
I had thrown out some ideas like, you know, something Kurt Russell, John Carpenter related, maybe something Lost Boys. But I, you know, the Teen Wolf and the Lost Boys one, I figured like might be a little bit more in her wheelhouse, you know, got a little bit of the horror aspect, right. But also some of that pop culture. And when she was excited to do the Teen Wolf one, I was excited to basically just like, I kind of just put it in her hands. I'm like, right. I mean, that's what I talked about. Like choosing the artist might've been at that point more important rather than me trying to design something or overly explain it. So she showed me the thing and I was like, looks awesome. Let's go. And it was a long 10 and a half hours.
So
we watched a bunch of movies.
Oh, you did. Very good.
Yeah.
What movies did you watch?
Well, initially Teen Wolf. And awesome. Then we started chatting about various films we like and character actors. So then we started watching Batman Returns. And we watched Clue. Then we watched Rocky Horror Picture Show. We watched Labyrinth. Then Beetlejuice. And then Cabin in the Woods.
Okay. So that's interesting because when I first saw your tattoo, which is a beautiful depiction of Teen Wolf, not dunking, but dribbling the basketball.
He's got the ball in the air.
He's got the ball. So I thought, initially, I thought, why not have him dunking? And I thought that was, but that was your original idea.
She had said when you're doing New School and like kind of like do these big heads and you're dealing with like the hair, it gets real convoluted. She's tried to do design like the dunk and it doesn't work out. So I mean, he could be doing a sky hook. He could be doing a variety of things, but he's got the ball in the air at least.
I like the idea if he's dribbling so badly that the ball is actually bouncing up near his head.
Yeah. And the sweat drops, I think, are to me like the
sweat drops are wonderful. He's got the full jersey. Oh, and you were wearing the jersey as well.
I was wearing So I got there, and since it's going on the shoulder, she's like, "Oh, I'll tape up your shirt." And I said, "Well, would it be easier if I was in a tank top?" She's like, "Well, whatever makes more sense for you." And so I took off my shirt to reveal the Scott Howard Beavers basketball jersey. She's like, "Yeah, that's way better. You should do that."
And I do like you're wearing the jersey and getting the tattoo of the wolf wearing the jersey.
Yeah, so there's kind of like why this design, you know, one, I think it looks pretty great. I mean, it's a pretty rad design. But I like basketball as a sport, probably my favorite sport to watch. So there's a basketball aspect of it for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously there's the 80s, there's the horror, there is that Howard element. You know, even the as a Warriors fan, I mean, even though it's his Beavers jersey, there's some Warriors coloring in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's kind of fun. The sweat is kind of like an homage to my wife.
Because how much she famously she hates sweaty movies. Yeah,
right.
I know that the beaver is your spirit animal, and
that's
so
true.
Yeah. So that's important.
Yeah, no, I was very, very pleased with it. It's still wrapped up, and they wrap it in like this thing called Saniderm, and it's like a second skin that sort of like keeps it keeps it from the elements, and it as it's oozing, because it'll ooze out, it's like your body's trying to uh-huh. fight off this infection or what it perceives as such. And I'm walking around in Salem and it is really humid, and we're getting ready to get our Uber to the airport, and we're actually getting picked up outside of the gallery because it's kind of a centralized place to, and so I'm reading up on like aftercare and all this stuff. And one of the things it says, like, oh, if you got the Saniderm on, you know, make sure you're not sweaty. And I'm like, wow, I'm drenched in sweat. So I take off my sweater and this thing has breached and I am just oozing all over all over the sweater. And our lift is like 3 minutes away. I'm like, ah, crap. And so I pop into the gallery. I'm like, hey, do you have like something I can wipe this up with? And they go, everyone, like, it just like almost like alarms were going off. Like, yeah, you're not getting on a plane. But we fixed this.
Oh, geez.
So they're like, they completely unwrap me, and they're like cleaning it off, and they go, okay, this part's going to suck. And then they just take a big old gauze full of alcohol and just wipe it. Holy Lord. That was probably of 10 and a half hours. There was not any pain that was quite like that. I mean, it was like peeing on fire all over again. Oh my, like, it was so painful that I just started laughing. Cause like my body is like, well, we don't know what to do. But they said, yeah, they're all, cause you're going to get on a plane and then the pressure is going to also, wreak havoc on it. And so
dang.
They wrap it up real tight. I get on the plane and sure enough, like probably like 3 hours into the flight, I could feel it. I'm like, oh, no. So at least it was manageable. But yeah, we patched it when I got home. And so now it's like it's in its own cocoon.
A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the 4th be with you all month and beyond.